Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhumann. Today we're live from Let's Talk About Food Festival at Harvard University. It's a beautiful October, perfect fall day. We're joined by two great guests, so thank you so much for joining us. Today we have Bree Warner, who's the CEO of Ocean Approved, a domestic leader in inline-grown sea vegetable food production. Hey, Bree, how you doing?
Good. Thanks, Aaron, for having me today.
Good. Yes. Hey, my pleasure, Bree. This is new for us to being on site and recording outside the studio, so we'll take it in stride, right?
Sounds great.
So, Bree, let me just get a little background of what you're up to, and then we'll jump into to questions thereafter. So, Bree, your company is hyper-focused on sourcing product from fishermen looking to diversify their income stream by starting ocean farms and growing kelp, a vegetable that improves the health of the ocean and provides huge nutritional benefit to its consumers. Bree was previously the Economic Development Director at the Island Institute, a nonprofit that works to sustain Maine's island and coastal communities, and has founded and sold a successful wholesale bakery in Portland, Maine. Is that right, Bree?
That's right.
Well, I got it's something
great.
Right today.
You got something right. Sounds beginning. Great. I should bring you along to sales calls. I feel like you could totally handle it.
I'm available.
Yeah.
I am available. All right. And we also have joining today Perry Rasso. Hey, Perry.
Hi. How are you?
Perry, you are the founder of Matunic Oyster Farm back in 2002, which is on Potter Pond in East Matunic, South Kingston, Rhode Island.
Yep.
Now, Perry, you, from what I've read in your background here, Matunic oysters are now sold at restaurants and stores from Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Maryland, and Georgia. Matunic Oyster Bar is a restaurant and raw bar opened in 2009 and serves fresh oysters harvested right off the waterfront patio in the pond adjacent to your property, as well as fresh vegetables grown on Rasso's, your certified organic Matunic vegetable farm, a full vertically integrated program.
Yeah, we started the organic vegetable farm after we started the restaurant. We started the restaurant after we started the oyster farm. Never planned on getting in the restaurant business, but purchased the restaurant because it had the only commercial docks on the pond, the salt pond, where we grow the Matunic oysters. And things progressed into the restaurant and the vegetable farm after the oyster farm.
That's fantastic. So if you're elevating the standards of your seafood, you got to bring the rest of the food along with it.
Right.
Cool.
And if you haven't been there, Aaron, or if any of your listeners haven't been, it's awesome.
It is
so
awesome.
So good. Yeah, and the oysters are killer.
What a setting,
And
too.
I'm from Maine, and so I shouldn't really say that from oysters outside of Maine, but man, they're pretty good.
You have high
oyster
bar.
Seed comes from Maine.
There you go.
It's from Musconetus
that
Bay.
Explains
we get
it.
Our,
that
you know, 20 million it. Baby oysters in like a small box, and it comes from Musconetus Bay, Maine. So
oh, there you go.
We get our seed from Maine.
All little, right. Well, they're delicious.
A little touch of Maine, right?
Yeah,
Rhode
that's
Island.
Right.
Yeah. And thank you for giving a shout out to Maine right there.
Yeah,
I
that's
was wondering
right.
when
I had
that
to get
plug
in.
Was going to go in there.
Yeah.
Great. All right. So our conversation today, we're going to explore the state of the oceans. We're going to talk about fisheries. And we're going to talk about the capacity for aquaculture, kind of better yet, the idea of regenerative ocean farming. And the idea of regenerative ocean farming is a bit of a riff off of regenerative farming of the soil. And effectively for our listeners, which most are familiar with regenerative just means that everything is renewed in the process of using it. Its ecology down to its trophic level and up through the interchange of those vast systems, which include food animals, mollusks, and ourselves. So without a doubt, we're in a situation today, 2018, where our seas are under threat, right? We've got floating plastic islands that are just but icing on the cake of a much bigger problem. And how we manage our oceans is the real epitome or the crux of that problem. It's a complex discussion with a simple solution. You see that we currently have 92% of our global fisheries are stressed or overstressed, and many of those are aligned with population densities that are soon to reach exhaustion. The South China Sea, for instance, is set to be exhausted from its fishery by 2025, and 40% of all consumption of seafood actually happens from the sourcing of the South China Sea. So the continued contamination of the waste that we spew into the channels of our food and all the supporting natural systems of the oceans will soon reach a ceiling, and it's going to hurt. It's going to hurt across the globe. And with 3 billion people relying on sea protein as their main caloric intake for the day, all this dirty or really no fish, we're going to be due a rude awakening. So we have alternatives, and there are solutions to this. So we've begun farming fish, and it's reached all corners of the planet. In fact, 50% of all fish consumed is raised in a farm. But most of that farm-raised stuff is nearer feedlot beef as compared to the clean, healthy moniker that open-caught seafood has and long since enjoyed. That's all changing is an understatement. And Bree and Perry, what you both are doing is really the impetus of this change, looking at the regenerative ocean farming, giving back to the natural resources so that you have a better crop. So maybe we can start there and talk a bit of the breakdown of ocean farming versus aquaculture versus fishing. And I think most listeners are somewhat aware, but that delineation point between aquaculture, which is often land-based, extractive-based agricultural models or aquaculture models, versus what you both are doing is very different. Maybe Bree, if you could start by sharing some thoughts on what you're doing with Ocean Approved and that approach to actually stringing out your sea greens into clean, cold waters of Maine and using it as a great advantage for both the ecology, the environment, and the consumers that eat your food.
Yeah, so I think I took over as CEO about 2 months ago. But something that I will say that I'm, one of the main reasons why I took it over and something I'm very proud of with the company is that our founders were actually founded the first seaweed farm in the United States. So it was about 8 years ago. Nobody knew, thought these guys were crazy, right? They were out there saying, we're gonna grow seaweed. And now we know that it's everywhere. People are always talking about seaweed, and we at Ocean Approved really started this a long time ago. And with that, we had 8 years of kind of developing new tactics, new techniques, but throughout that whole process, we were dedicated to making sure that we were sourcing sustainably. So we started with our tiny farm, then we expanded to two farms. And this year, I just turned over our farms to another farmer because we have 18 partner farms up the coast of Maine. We've trained them all on how to do sea farming, and they're all fishermen. So that's really exciting because these are people that are in the lobster fishery looking to diversify their income through seaweed. It's a really cheap project to start for them. I mean, it doesn't take, once you have your own boat and you have your own lines, many of those guys know how to set their own moorings too, right? So it's a pretty cheap way to get in, and it's a winter crop. And what they always tell me is, of course they know how to grow seaweed. I grow it on my lobster traps all the time. Like, this is easy. And quite frankly, many of their spouses want them the hell out of the house in the winter, so they have something to do in the winter. But it's an opposite crop of lobster, so it works out great. So we have 18 partner farms this year that we're gonna be buying from. We produce all of our seeds in the nursery. We give it to our farmers, and then we buy it back. We call it womb to tomb in our facility because we produce them, and then we buy it back, and we process it into value-added products from there. It's always it's never dried, never dyed. Flash frozen, blanched, bright green because of its natural color and blanching. So pretty innovative stuff. But in the past 3 years on our farm, we've had scientists out there saying, okay, well, we know that kelp is good for the ocean, but how good is it? We know that when we put this seaweed in the water, we're actually making the water better than it was before, which you can say with almost nothing other than mussels and oysters.
Right.
And so Bigelow Laboratories and the Island Institute did a study where they put mussels underneath the halo of our farm. And they found that the shell strength was stronger because it actually remediated the effects of ocean acidification because it took carbon and nitrogen out of the water, two things that we have too much of in the Gulf of Maine. And the mussel meat was bigger. They don't know if that's because the mussels were actually feeding off the kelp or if it was because of taking out the carbon and nitrogen, but certainly the shell strength was a direct result. So all that to say, in when you're talking about regenerative agriculture, we're still learning about all the good effects that kelp can have. And as like the last piece of this, I actually just signed a letter of support for a group that's trying to do research on feeding help to cows to reduce methane emission.
Yes.
I said cow farts. It's actually cow burps that they're trying to reduce through this,
really?
Which I was under the wrong impression. But I mean, that's pretty exciting. We're still learning all the amazing effects that it can have. So
it's fantastic. It's extractive-based agriculture rather than input-based programs, right? It solved the potato famine in Ireland years ago, centuries ago. So there's got to be some impetus of potential change.
Right.
And what an opportunity for Maine, which
has been really,
you know, somewhat oppressed in the way that their fisheries have come together recently. The loss of the fin fishery, reliant on a lobster fishery, to have supplementary revenue streams, risk diversification, unique opportunities for the fishermen there to diversify their offerings. What a chance.
And Maine is made for this, first of all, because we grow damn good kelp up there. The weather is perfect for it, but also because fishermen in Maine, the license structure is such that you can only have one boat. You can't have kind of a fleet of boats. So these are independent farmers. They all run their own businesses. And we have 5,000 plus license holders that can be activated like this if they get interested in it. So it's a great deal for Maine for a number of reasons, but we really are on the cutting edge in our state, and I think Ocean Approved is leading the way on really, you know, making seaweed a food that can feed a lot of people. You know, that's got better, more potassium than banana, more calcium than orange juice or milk. It's just a super healthy product, and versus the Asian product, which is often high in heavy metals. That bright green dye you see on your seaweed salad is yellow 5 and blue 9, and all the reasons you don't drink Mountain Dew.
Yep.
Or at least I imagine most of your listeners don't drink too much Mountain Dew.
Only in corners.
Yeah, only in corners.
Backs turned to the wall.
But that's really why, there's a lot of reasons not to eat the Asian stuff that you can get at sushi restaurants mostly. But ours has the added benefit of having none of that plus a lot of nutrients in it because of our clean, fresh, cold waters.
Fantastic. Again, you should work for the Tourism Agency of Maine.
Always, Aaron. Always promoting
Maine. I'm a big fan, too.
It's easy to promote.
That's right. 3,500 miles of coastline in Maine.
That's right.
Let's go. So that's the biggest state in New England. Let's go to the smallest state in New England. And Perry, let's talk about what's going on in Rhode Island down in Matunuck. Because what I have been having a chance to come visit what you're up to and that vertical integration that you've created, not just in your oyster production, your seed and hatchery, the restaurant, but then adding the terrestrial production model, that is very unique. But I think it stems from my understanding of your commitment to producing a highest quality bivalve. Can you share with us a little bit of how you got into creating an oyster production program and how it's stretched out over the last couple of years?
Sure. I started in the wild fishery, wild harvesting shellfish, digging with a rake for clams, and then scuba diving for them, and then scuba diving for steamers, working on offshore boats as well. I learned the value in shellfish in that stage in my life, and you know, learning the details of how oysters are grown. At University of Rhode Island, I started a 1-acre farm upon finishing my undergraduate degree, and you know, expanded the farm to 7 acres over the course of about 5 years, and I really I enjoyed the fact that I could the more I put into it, the more I got out of it, and I could physically see the benefits of the work done and then be rewarded months or years after doing the work, because oysters take several years to get to market size, and that really drove me. The restaurant was kind of a mistake. I needed the commercial docks, and I knew I needed the docks for the oyster farm, and the docks happened to be attached to this restaurant that was closed for several years, and it was kind of a rundown clam shack. So against a lot of people's advice, I opened the restaurant in 2009, figuring out that this thing's not going to work, and then make it a fish market, or I'll live here. I just know I need the docks, and people. You know, we opened the restaurant with the farm to plate theme, and people flocked to it. And so we wound up being a year-round business, open lunch and dinner all year round. And you know, after a couple of years, I seek a lot of advice. I don't take everybody's advice, but I ask for a lot of advice. And I uh, I some people in the restaurant business said, you know, you'll see Perry in the restaurant business. You get busier and busier and busier, then you plateau and then you start to go down. And I'm like, oh no, I can't go down, you know, I have too many bills to pay now. And so to separate our restaurant from other businesses, I started an organic vegetable farm, because we were buying vegetables from other farmers, but most vegetable farmers in Rhode Island are growing mainly for their own farmers markets or something like that, so we wouldn't be able to get the volume that we needed to supply a restaurant. So we started, we have 2 6-acre vegetable fields with 200-foot greenhouses, and pretty much how it started. Going forward, we're looking to start a shellfish hatchery. So as much as we love buying seed from Maine, we'd like to be able to be more self-sufficient and rely on ourselves for producing our own oyster seed, as well as be able to provide other growers in Rhode Island with a product. So, those are some directions forward for us.
Rhode Island has quite a lineage in shellfish production. I think there's only a couple hundred acres in active production now, but back in 1900, there were over 20,000 acres of shellfish production within Rhode Island. I guess we have all those terrestrial environments and good breeding grounds for growing different shellfish. But let me ask this, Perry, if I could. In the world of shellfish, I think your group has been very successful in introducing differentiation, product differentiation. In wine, we call it terroir, the taste of place. And I think even seafood has gone a layers deeper, where we have now the people, place, and product associated where food is coming from. Where if you go to a good oyster bar, you can get huge product differentiation 5 miles up and down the coast, depending on where you are.
Yeah.
Yeah, please.
So I always compare it to wine. You have a vineyard on one side of the road growing the same variety of grape as a vineyard on the other side of the road, and they yield totally different products. And oyster farming is very similar. There's greater variation among different regions. An oyster grown in Rhode Island is going to taste a little bit different from one estuary to another, but it's going to be even a more drastic difference from Rhode Island to Chesapeake, and even greater from Rhode Island to the Gulf, and then the same difference from the East Coast to the West Coast, where there's different species. So even though we're all growing the same species of oyster on the East Coast, there is a lot of variation due to how it's grown, where it's grown. Probably the most noticeable difference is in the taste is the salinity, how briny or not the oyster is. Most of them here in the Northeast are pretty briny, as opposed to the ones from down south. And if it's grown in the water column, it might have more of an iron or a brownish look to it. Or if it's grown on the sea floor, that the shell might be a more of a white or emerald. So there's a lot of variation, as well as in size. What determines an oyster's growth is something called cestin flux, milligrams of food, phytoplankton, times liters per minute. How much food and how much flow is in the water body. So some areas have a lot of food, a lot of flow, they grow quick. They might have not as deep of a cup. You might have a place with just a lot of food and not a lot of flow, and they grow well, but just not nearly as quick, and they'll wind up usually a little bit more uniform.
Yeah.
I heard that Perry hugs each one before he puts them
in the water.
So
yes,
that's actually what makes it
calms them.
That's
taste.
Personal.
Yeah.
Well, I think you had hit on a key point, which gets back to the discussion here of regenerative ocean farming and giving back to the environment. Each of those bivalves are cleaning 50 gallons of water every day, right? So it matters greatly the environment that you're raising your shellfish in.
Oysters and the mechanism by which they feed, filter feeding, eating phytoplankton, microscopic plants that are naturally occurring in the water. The phytoplankton isn't bad for the environment, as you can imagine, but in an abundance and lead to low oxygen levels. Phytoplankton photosynthesize all day, and the sun goes down, they can't photosynthesize, so they respirate, take oxygen out of the water. So after a long, hot day, that's when there's the most amount of phytoplankton in the water. The sun goes down, all that phytoplankton respirating adds up to low oxygen levels, and that can lead to fish kills. Have you ever seen a beach or a pond strewn with thousands of dead fish? Always after a long, hot day. And shellfish and other filter feeding organisms reduce that occurrence from happening. Shellfish, by filter feeding, they're not only eating the food, but they're also filtering out other suspended sediment and depositing on the sea floor,
yeah.
As a pseudo feces is what it, because it's not digested. It's and that clears the water and allows more light to penetrate and allows for aquatic vegetation, which is essential fish habitat. Increases biodiversity. You can dive on any shellfish farm in the world, and you'll see more biodiversity within that farm than in the adjacent water body. So we have, we look at it, fluke, flounder, all sorts of different living animals within shrimps, everything.
It's so essential because those areas are also where the keystone species are from, right? I mean, they're really the health of the ocean are coming from these marine environments where shellfish are so important. And returning back to Paul Greenberg's book, actually, in Four Fish, he talks about New York was surrounded by 7 trillion oysters. It used to clean the East River up and down until we started putting raw sewage in there, which obviously had a drastic change in that. But that matters greatly. As a consumer of a raw bar, I love going to the raw bar, it matters what water you're pulling your shellfish out of. So Bree, let's go back up to Maine. Let's venture up there and talk about the potential for sea greens. I've read there's 10,000 types of vegetation that grows in the ocean that are edible by man. Not that they taste good, but that there's potential. So what is the capacity on that 3,500 miles of seacoast in Maine to grow out large volumes of sea greens and seaweed for diverse audiences?
So I'll say the amount you can grow in a small space is significant. And that's one of the great pieces about both oysters and seaweed, is that you can literally put a boat over our farm and not see it, right? We're 7 feet down off the water. You can put a boat over it. All you see is a bunch of moorings. You can grow about 3 to 7 pounds per foot. So you're really talking, you don't need that much acreage to get a ton of seaweed and a ton of protein and calcium and all the vitamins. So there's a lot of space out there. It's really low visibility, very low impact, and you don't need that much. So we could really feed a lot, most of the country, just from small parts of Maine without making a huge impact to the coast. I think you'll hear from pretty much every Mainer that you really don't want to see the coast change.
Yeah.
And that's what's so great about seaweed, is it actually allows us to stay the way that we are in a lot of ways, because it gives people another source of income to keep being on the water. But it also doesn't have much of a visual impact, and it's better for the ocean. You don't need that much land for it.
Right.
So it's a pretty exciting product that way.
And I'll state that our guests are doing a fantastic job. We're right in the middle of Harvard Science Center. We got people walking by, got tons of distractions, and you guys are on point right now. So I'm very impressed by the answers I'm getting. But I want to continue that, Bree, and talk more about the capacity of impact investing in sea green production, and Perry also in shellfish production. Because I think it's key to look at this. You know, there's been in the investment world, there's been a lot of interest in impact investing, which usually has a secondary variable. It's not just fiduciary returns. There's something else that comes out of it. But for the industries that you are both in, we're talking about place-based investing. We're talking about local dollars spent. We're talking about local jobs, preserving of working waterfronts. It's an opportunity for consistent supply of local and regional food. And as we talked about, your approach is fundamentally environmentally positive action on your environment so you get a better crop. Is that resonating with investors? Is that resonating with consumers? Who's your strike point at this point for growing your industry and developing capacity building in the Northeast?
With, I know the industry that I'm, in right now, I think it's not a lack of, people's willing to invest interest in the product. Demand is certainly there. Right now, it is definitely user group issues.
Yeah.
People love the idea of shellfish, and we enjoyed that for, I'd say, a couple decades, where the aquaculture industry had this, go farmer mentality. And that certainly changed over the last few years, where there's growing resistance, and you know, which I can definitely relate to. I remember as a wild harvester being so frustrated as I drove through an oyster farm because I couldn't dig there, and you know, it would. So I get it, but at the same time, you know, we need to grow our seafood, and I know, just to lightly touch on fin fish farms have gone the way of more the way of feedlots or beef feedlots. I would contend that we have to grow our seafood, and the technology that we have to grow our seafood, particularly fin fish, has increased drastically over the last few decades. So it's got a long way to go, but it's also come a long way. So I know the industry's gotten a black eye in a lot of areas, but you know, we have to grow our seafood here in the U.S. I read just recently, I think in Maine, they're producing some 20 or so tons of salmon a year. Well, the U.S. imports close to 300,000 tons of salmon a year. So, you know, are they growing it up to our, standards here in the U.S.? Or if not, maybe we should consider, ways that we can, work with other user groups to be able to produce seafood here. That's a little bit of way askew of, the shellfish farming idea where, I think in Rhode Island, they've determined that no more than 5% of any given water body can be used for growing shellfish. And that's to kind of alleviate some concern of when will the growth of the aquaculture industry stop. But the reality is most water bodies haven't even approached 5%, and the resistance of the industry's growth is at the rate it's going, it looks like it's not even going to get close to 5%. So I think it's a mentality, and I think you nailed it. People don't want to see change, people in Maine, people in Rhode Island, myself. But at the same time, it's going to happen one way or another. And I think, growing seafood, is one of those changes that we're going to realize, whether it's because we're growing it here or because we're growing it overseas.
Yeah, Bree, if you comment as well, please.
Well, and on your impact investing point, I think with, oysters are proven out to a point. I mean, I think there's a lot of, it's still a pretty nascent industry, but as compared to sea vegetables, it's an old industry, right? We're very new here in the U.S. The domestic market is 99% imported, and most of the seaweed that is domestic is wild harvested. So, as far as line grown seaweed, there's us and a few others out there. It's not big. So impact investors right now are our sweet spot. What I dream about is that people are starting to see the writing on the wall, that this is really the wave of the future, like Perry said. And I hear in 10 years, hey, Bree, like, this is a great investment opportunity, you know? And I'm hearing that right now in impact investing because people are really excited to see where it goes. But when they ask me about the domestic market for seaweed, I say, I don't know. Yeah. Let's create it.
Yeah.
And that's a really different spot than many of the fin fish points. But to me, that's really exciting. From a business point of view, it's exciting because that means we're first movers.
Yeah.
And people want to eat healthy and they want to eat local, and we can't, we couldn't supply all the people that want our stuff right now. From a industry perspective, I hope in 5 or 6 years I look back and say, great, our company made huge moves as the first mover. Now there are also others in the space doing different types of product, and it's no longer this innovative impact opportunity, but one that's feeding the world, and that would be really exciting to me.
Yeah, there's a couple cool schools of thought associated with what you're talking about, that what is impact investing now is really going to turn into a new cost basis for circular economies, where we have more of a systems thinking approach of where we spend and invest our money. And, Perry, I think you hit on a key point, which is interesting, because we're talking about all capacity growing around new market share, but we're also living within a world that business as usual within a lot of the shellfish industry. So New Bedford being a good example, one of the largest fisheries in the U.S. around our scallop production, but that's completely or virtually all reliant on open caught fishery. And I know you're also involved in your seed hatchery looking at bay scallops. So do you see a drastic change in that marketplace of open caught fishery, issues with our warming waters, of maybe using a farming approach that's going to replace even fin fishery programs moving forward?
I don't know that we're ever going to, aquaculture is ever going to, at least in my lifetime, fill the role of the wild capture fisheries, even though, I believe it's probably just over 50% of what humans eat now is farm-raised.
Right.
I know over 50% of what the U.S. imports is farm-raised, and by the way, the amount of seafood we import, the number two import in the United States is seafood, second to oil. So it is, I'm excited about the prospect of, being able to grow, seafood here that we import, whether the imports are wild or farm-raised. For example, bay scallops is something I'm really excited about. You can go down the street and buy bay scallops from the grocery store for $8 or $9 a pound. They came from China. They were, some scientists from China were savvy enough to go to a Milford NOAA lab a couple decades ago and went home with a few dozen bay scallops that we are local species here, and went back to China and grow them so efficiently that they sell them back to us for a price that we can't even come close to competing.
Right.
However, certainly not fresh by the time they get here. A fresh local bay scallop.
They're often weighed added.
Oh, yeah, weighed added.
They put them on water,
or whatever.
Grain, and most people don't know that.
Yeah. That's
right?
People say, what do they mean dry scallops? It means they weren't, so just enjoy them, don't worry.
It's like, when people see the big, big scallops, uh-huh. they think that must make them better. They uh-huh. have no idea. It's mostly weight.
But Ross, we're lucky here. We have great local fresh sea
that's
scallops.
Right.
But we have very limited fresh local bay scallops. Nantucket has a market for a season for them, and there's some here and there. But, hopefully we'll be at the point where we're producing large amounts, and you'll be able to buy, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Maine bay scallops in the grocery store as well. Might not be $9 a pound, but they'll be much better.
And it is interesting for the export market for you both, because one of the big concerns that we've heard is a kind of a macro trend is, sure, China's producing volumes of shellfish, but they're growing it in waterways that are contaminated with heavy metals. And even the locals within that environment, if they have the resources, are looking outside. They're looking for French oysters. They're looking for Irish mussels. They're looking for anything coming from the U.S. of elevated standard. Just the declaration of coming from the States has associated value. So maybe for a last question, if I could get you both to comment or share, what do you think everyone should know, something different about what you're up to, and what would you like your audience, your consumers, to know about your product, about your industry, that they may not currently understand?
I mentioned the next step for our business is to start a shellfish hatchery so we can become more horizontally integrated, and that would be a process. It's in the permitting process, which is a long process, but moving in the right direction. I think I would say that aquaculture on a global scale, aquaculture is the fastest growing food producing industry in the world. We need to embrace it. We need to accept that it is an appropriate use of our waters, as well as recreational and other commercial uses. Farming is has a very important role in our bays, estuaries, and open ocean, hopefully eventually too. If we're going to have a more resilient local food production system here.
Bree?
I guess I would say about our product specifically is that seaweed doesn't have to be hard and foreign. It can be something you can just defrost and eat, which is what we have particularly. You don't have to fuss with a bunch of dried product, and it's not that foreign. You can put it on in pasta, you can put it on tacos, and just get a little nutrition every day. It's easy to eat. That's the big thing that I want people to know, is seaweed's not scary.
Right.
But the other thing is exactly what Perry said. The aquaculture has also gotten a pretty bad name over the past 20 years. Some of it probably rightfully so for some parts of aquaculture, and some of it just carries over to industries where it's not deserved. And oysters, mussels, and seaweed for sure are making the ocean better. So I think, you know, from the product specific point of easy use, but just aquaculture in general, is let's check our thoughts about aquaculture at the door and rethink about how we're using products from the sea, and where we want to be buying our food. And I think people will find pretty quickly that the way that Perry and I are growing things is really going to improve both their health but also the ocean's health, and that's something you can't say for much.
Right. I would also add to that, Brie, your smoothie cubes are quite good.
Aren't they awesome?
Yeah, they're really good.
You can
really
stick them in your smoothie every morning and you don't even taste seaweed.
You don't even taste seaweed.
Yep.
A little scent of the sea. Puts you right in the mindset, or you should be, right?
I hide it in my kids' food all the time.
All the time. And I will continue to ping you about putting the red sea greens in production too, because what an opportunity for gelatin replacement,
right? There's so many things you can do
incredible
with seaweed.
Amount of
So I just heard, as a side note, I just heard about these people in Korea who are using seaweed to make water pods to reduce plastic use.
Yes.
Right. That's so cool.
It is
you
cool.
can use it for so many things.
Yeah. Brie, where can our listening audience learn more about Ocean Approved? Is there a website? Is there a place that they can buy the product?
Yep. So right now you can buy it in a ton of restaurants in New England and down the coast. You can go to Flatbread Company and buy it on a salad.
Oh,
you
one
can
of my
buy
favorites,
it on
Brie.
Legal
yeah.
Seafoods and buy it as a side dish with cucumbers. There are a ton of, we're in food service right now, but check us out in March. We will be launching a huge retail line. Follow us on social media on our website for updates, but you should be able to see it in your local grocer in March.
Fantastic. And Perry, should we come visit the restaurant?
Yeah, we'll have your seaweed soon here too, because
awesome.
I'm looking forward to giving that
a
try.
Deal's getting done.
There you
right
go.
That's right.
Definitely.
So yeah, we are Southern Rhode Island, Matunuck Oyster Bar, rhodeoysters.com. And, you know, we're year-round, open 7 days a week, lunch and dinner. And, you know, we are looking forward to, you know, continuing to be part of the local food system.
So I'll put a link down at the bottom of each write-up so folks that listen to it on iTunes or on the website will have access to this, and hopefully you get some buyers out of this
Great.
As well, right?
I will also say with seaweed and oysters, if you're at your local restaurant and you see something that's bright green and dyed, tell your restaurateur that there's another alternative out there. And, you know, I think that you'll find that people want to find an alternative. They just don't know it's out there. But same with oysters. If you find an oyster that is kind of big and ugly and doesn't taste very good, you can probably be pretty sure it's not from Perry or any of us in New England.
Right.
So definitely, it's going to drive from the consumers as well.
So be an advocate. Or,
that's
or
right.
Maybe Brie saying be an antagonist.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah. Bother the crap out of them.
I like it. They should be held up to these standards.
That's right.
Okay, so these local ocean farmers have developed models that will give back to their natural environment to reap the benefit of a better crop. It just makes sense. And by addressing sea level rise and storm surge and alleviating hunger in impoverished areas and creating local jobs for highly populated areas, sourcing clean seafood as preventative human care, or stabilizing natural environments in keystone areas, these motivated champions are fighting for a cleaner environment. They are regenerative ocean farmers that have vast potential for all coastal communities everywhere in the world. So I can't thank you both enough for partaking in today's conversation. I want to thank Harvard University for putting on a great festival. It's Let's Talk About Food Festival. Louisa Kajdan, who did a fantastic job of putting this together. What an opportunity for Sourcing Matters. We have a dogfight in the background. Everything going on here.
You know, there was the Harvard Eagle was walking back and forth behind
right?
you most of the time. So it was
yeah.
a little bit, it was hard to really... take it as seriously.
Yeah, there's lots going on back there, actually.
Well, thank you both for partaking, and I'll say until next time.
Thank you.
Thanks, Aaron.